going to take a look at American birding coming up here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, and as we often do on a Wednesday program, we like to take a look at the outdoors and nature, and today we're going to be visiting with Scott Wiedenthal. Scott is the author of the book Of a Feather, A Brief History of American Birding, and really pleased to have him with us by phone today. He's a sought-after expert on nature and birds. He's written several books, one a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, as a matter of fact, and one of my favorite bird watchers, Jim Packer, joins us. And Jim, we have some goals to reach during this
hour. Indeed, we do, Larry. We have a significant goal of $12,000 for the full program, and we'll get there when you make your call to make your financial support for Wisconsin Public Radio known at 800-383-9772, or, of course, you can go online at wpr.org. For a pledge of $12.50 a month, or $150, we'll be glad to send along a copy of Scott's book, Of a Feather, and also the member benefit card, which entitles you to two-for-one entrees at over 250 restaurants, and two-for-one admission at various performances and attractions, some online shopping discounts, and the bed and breakfast benefit, which is two nights for the price of one at 40-some bed and breakfasts in Wisconsin, Illinois, and Minnesota. So that's available for the $150 pledge. If you just like the card alone, why, that's available at $120, but it goes at 800-383-9772 or at WPR.org, and you're pledging for Larry Mueller's program.
And you're also pledging to help us reach a challenge grant that we have now, a $1,500 challenge grant from some anonymous donors who say, well, if you make your $12,000 during this 90-minute program, we'll be glad to add another $1,500 to the mix. So we make $12,000, add a $1,500, that's $13,500, which is a very significant amount of money. And you're going to really, I think, enjoy listening to Scott Wiedenthal, who's written a wonderful book here. Jim and I both have had a chance to read it, the book Of a Feather. I have been amazed at some of the characters that have been involved in birding over the years, some who have really made birding such a popular, I don't know if it's a sport is the proper word or not. I'll ask Scott that question, if he would consider it a sport, but certainly a pastime and an avocation for millions of people across the United States. It's a fascinating book. You're going to enjoy it, and for a $150 contribution, we're going to be happy to send it to you. It's easy to call and make your contribution at 1-800-383-9772. No problem. It'll take you a couple of minutes on the phone. But also, if you're listening, a lot of people listen online, or even if you're not listening online, you can go online to WPR.org. That's WPR.org. You can make your contribution there. Everything is safe and secure. And also, at the same time, you can print out your receipt so that you've got something for your tax purposes right there in your hot hands.
Indeed, 800-383-9772 or WPR.org. I know that looking at some comments from our technical people, that about 700 people are listening during this prime time of day, which happens to be during your show, Larry. Rather than in the early morning or the late evening, they're concentrated in here. And so if you're one of those people and you are living in Brooklyn or Saskatoon and you're watching and listening on the Internet, then why not go ahead and make your commitment to help us today? Because the quality that you hear in our programming reflects a great financial investment, and many of these costs are associated directly with broadcasting. NPR, the Associated Press, and all the sophisticated equipment cost money, and of course we pay for the light, the heats, and the telephones to give you the 800 service that you enjoy if you travel around the state or elsewhere. So why not pledge your support to help us pay for the programs today that you will enjoy for the next year at 800-383-9772 or at WPR.org.
Wisconsin Public Radio is listener-supported. You are our biggest source of support, financial support. And so we really rely on you. So call in now with a contribution. $150, we'll send you a copy of Scott's book and the member benefit card. $120, we'll still send you that member benefit card. But again, the number is 1-800-383-9772. And I want to turn now to Scott Weidensahl, who is with us by phone. Scott, hi. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Well, it's a pleasure.
I tell you what, I really enjoyed reading your book. I was surprised at some of the characters in the book.
Well, yeah. I mean, the history of bird study in America is populated with a rather colorful set of people. There's no question about that. I mean, starting all the way back in the earliest days of European settlement and coming forward. I mean, you have people like John James Audubon that most folks are familiar with, who himself is just there. You know, there's lots of layers to the onion that was John James Audubon, illegitimate child, self-taught naturalist, congenital liar. but an absolute genius when it came to artwork or ornithology. But one of his contemporaries was a fellow named Alexander Wilson, who's
another character.
Yes, revered today as the father of American ornithology. But he came here in 1794 from Scotland. He was a mill worker, was penniless, was a convicted blackmailer, a failed poet. Was interested in birds, I think, in kind of a casual, gee, let's go gunning today sense, but he set foot in the New World and was actually hiking from Wilmington, Delaware, to Philadelphia, and was just dazzled with the birds he saw, and decided kind of on the spot to make it his life work to catalog all of these, you know, this endless variety of birds, drawing them, creating engravings and hand coloring them, and compiling them into a series of books he called The American Ornithology, even though he didn't even know what most of them were.
Yeah, that's an amazing thing. But he did, for the time, and it was the first one, the first book, the first series of books. They were beautiful books.
They really were. I mean, there were some people as far back as the early 1700s, another Englishman named Mark Catesby, who came over here and spent a number of years traveling through the Southeast from Virginia down to Florida and out into the Bahamas, painting the birds and animals and plants that he saw and writing about them. William Bartram, who was the first American naturalist really to pay attention to birds in the late 1700s, but these were for the most part these were self-taught naturalists. In the case of Bartram, once again, another kind of he failed at so many things. Benjamin Franklin offered to take him on as an apprentice, and he turned that down. He failed at business. He failed at farming. And it wasn't until he was in his 30s that he turned himself to traveling throughout the new United States and writing about the birds and other species that he saw. And it really made his reputation for posterity.
You know, and as you point out in the book, too, I think one of the interesting things about ornithology is the contributions of, quote-unquote, amateur ornithologists, as opposed to what you might call the professional types.
Well, yeah, and in fact, in the beginning, they were all amateurs.
Right, of course.
Most scientists were amateurs. There were in the 18th century, there wasn't really any place you could go to school to become a scientist. You just took your native enthusiasm and curiosity and went from there. It wasn't really until the 19th century that bird study became formalized into a profession, especially in the mid to late 19th century. And interestingly enough, as ornithology, the science began to gel, you also had bird watching as a pastime starting to rise as an avocation among people who were not necessarily scientists or of a scientific bent. And it was interesting in the course of writing this book, as somebody who has been a birder all of my life and is involved with field research with birds, to see how those two strands kind of, would weave together for a while and then separate and then come back together again. And each one, that cross-pollination really added to each side.
It was an interesting. There were some things that struck me and thinking about Audubon, well, any of the people who were involved in this, that How the way they were able to get good close looks at things was to shoot them.
Well, yes, and in fact, I pointed out to my editor when she suggested the subtitle "A Brief History of American Birding" that nobody picks up a pair of binoculars until two-thirds of the way through this book. I mean, up to that point, it's all shotguns, And, you know, birders today, people tend to be kind of aghast at the idea of Audubon out there shooting all the birds that he painted, and the same with Wilson and all of these early ornithologists. But, I mean, think about it. There were no cameras. There were no binoculars.
Yeah.
You know, you're facing a continent with what we know today is, you know, more than 800 species of birds in this bewildering array of plumages, you know, males, females, adults, immatures. You know, the plumages change seasonally in some birds. There's as many as 40 different plumages just of one species of hawk, the red-tailed hawk. And so making sense of all that required a specimen in the hand. It was the only way that they could do it. And in fact, even today, you know, this fairly, you know, bloodless sport of bird watching is based on those museum specimens. You know, the field guides that you buy, the paintings in them are frequently based on you know, the artist spending hours and hours of tedious work in museums looking at specimen skins. And so, you know, it's on that necessary, although somewhat bloodthirsty, step of early ornithology that, you know, that modern bird watching is based.
I want to give people a chance to join in. If you have a question for Scott Wiedenthal as we talk with him today about his book, Of a Feather, A Brief History of American Birding, feel free to join in. He's actually a federally licensed bird banner, lives in Pennsylvania, the Appalachian Mountain area. Really happy to have him with us. And you can join us with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or in Madison at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions and with your comments. There's so many interesting characters in the book, and there's a fair amount of intrigue, especially in the early times, well, even in the later times too, but Alexander Wilson and John James Audubon, I guess they'd met, they knew each other, but Audubon was a poor businessman.
That's putting it kindly. and Audubon would have been the first one to tell you that. He had no interest in business. I mean, people have to understand what Audubon's background was. His father was a French naval captain who had a little illicit affair with a chambermaid on her way to Haiti, and so Audubon was born in Haiti as the illegitimate son of this naval captain. At an early age, when he was just a few years old, his father was concerned about a slave revolt in Haiti, and justly so, as it turns out, brought young Audubon back to France, formally adopted him, gave him his name, you know, made him officially part of the family. When Audubon was 19, his father, again, you know, very sensitive to the political winds, recognized that his son was in danger of being conscripted into Napoleon's army and sent him to the New World, where the elder Audubon owned an estate right outside of Philadelphia called Mill Grove, right next to Valley Forge. And the idea was to send Audubon over there, and as a young man of 19 or 20, he could learn to manage the estate and become a young gentleman. Well, John James, he had changed his name from Jean Rabin. He was having none of this. He wanted to hunt. He wanted to fish. He wanted to ice skate. He wanted to dance. He wanted to court pretty Lucy Bakewell at the neighboring estate. And most of all, he wanted to paint birds. And even after he and Lucy got married, moved west to the frontier in Kentucky with a friend of his from France, who they went into business together at first in Louisville and then later by himself in Henderson, Kentucky, as a storekeeper. You know, he said the only part of being a storekeeper that really interested him were the long trips back to Pennsylvania for supplies, so he spent weeks traveling across Ohio and Pennsylvania collecting birds. It was really just by dumb luck that one day in March of 1810 that he was in his shop in Louisville when Alexander Wilson came in. Wilson was peddling copies of subscriptions, actually, to his American Ornithology, which was the only way that you could pay for such a monumental publishing undertaking. And, you know, he met this shopkeeper with a sort of eccentric French-accented English who almost bought a subscription to the book. And then the fellow's business partner came in and said something to him in French, and what he said was, you know, my dear Audubon, why are you doing this? Your paintings are so much better. Now, you have to understand, we're getting this from Audubon.
Yeah.
We don't know what Wilson thought. Wilson wrote in his journal when he left Louisville that science and literature has not one friend in this town. And Audubon claims that Wilson was just dazzled by the paintings that Audubon had done and clearly saw the you know, the superior artistic merit in them. What I suspect happened was that Audubon was kind of muddling along as a reasonably good painter. Even in those days, he was a better painter than Wilson was. We just uncovered, actually, a beautiful painting from around that time from Henderson, Kentucky, that really shows the early genius of John James Audubon. But I think he got the idea at that point. The little light bulb went off in his head, and he thought, I can do this, too. I can do my own American ornithology. And, of course, he called it the Birds of America. It was these huge four-volume, what's known as the double elephant folio because of their size, of these enormous life-size paintings of birds in vivid life. I mean, Wilson's birds, as was the typical of the day, were stiff and fairly dead and lifeless on the page. And Audubon would shoot the birds while they were still warm. He would wire them up in lifelike positions based on his intimate knowledge of these birds from the wild and paint them life-size. And no one had ever done anything like that. I mean, he really changed the way that we look at the natural world.
And he painted them with, or had someone else help him to paint branches and things like that, which also was a new touch, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, it's actually, that's something that the idea of having an artistic assistant goes back to the Renaissance. It was something that a lot of professional artists did. What Audubon would do, I mean, when he was in the midst of creating Birds of America, you know, it was more than 435 of these enormous paintings. He would spend, for example, 6 weeks in the wilderness of Pennsylvania collecting birds, and I think he painted something like 96 paintings that came out of that period. He didn't have time to do the whole thing. So he would collect the birds, he would draw the composition, he would paint the bird, he would pick the individual plants, you know, the foliage, the flowers, whatever was going in the background, and oversee their completion by his assistants, who were you know, people like George Lehman, who were extraordinarily talented landscape artists, respected artists in their own right. And so that combination of his artistic eye, particularly with the birds, and these assistants created these just dazzling works that we still admire today.
Yeah. Scott Weidenthal, our guest today, author of A Feather, A Brief History of American Birding. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking about the birds of America today with Scott Weidenthal, author of A Feather, A Brief History of American Birding. We're not only talking about the birds, but the birders as well, the people who laid the groundwork for the tremendous interest that we have today, so many of us have today, in birds and bird watching. And I'm really pleased to have him with us. If you would like to join in with a question or comment of your own as we talk birds with him and birders, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. In the Madison area, you can reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions and comments. One of the things that I remember from your book, you mentioned a little earlier the millions of birds that were in existence at that time in the United States in America. Wilson and Audubon had the advantage of seeing a lot of birds that we can't see today because they're not here anymore.
Well, that's right, and in fact, one of the things that you see when you go back and look at these early accounts from the very first European settlers back through the 1600s, 1700s, these people were just gobsmacked by the birds that they saw here, the variety of them, and as you say, the numbers of them. And a little bit of that is probably, you know, overly active imaginations, but we know, like, for example, you mentioned Wilson again, that, you know, he was the first person to try to quantify the number of passenger pigeons that were migrating, you know, throughout the East and the Midwest. And, you know, he saw flocks that took days to pass, and he figured and felt rather conservatively that if you figured that each square yard of air, you know, as he said, comprehended three pigeons, the total came out to something like 2 billion pigeons that, you know, were darkening the sky, you know, making you know, droppings falling as thick as a heavy snow. It must have been incredible. And to see Carolina parakeets, you know, these brilliant green birds with bright orange heads that were found all across the East and Southeast, you know, ivory-billed woodpeckers and the eastern prairie chickens known as heath hens, you know, many of these species of birds that are gone today, and just numbers of birds overall. I mean, this was an undiminished continent at that point. And as dr- dramatic as spring migration is today, with all of these warblers and vireos and other colorful songbirds coming back from the tropics, what it must have been like in the 1700s and 1800s, before the forests fell, before the landscape was altered so dramatically, what it must have been like to experience, you know, summertime on an undiminished tall grass prairie. I mean, and I would give almost anything to have been able to see that.
Yeah, you're right about that. Well, let's take a call. Dave in Cumberland, thank you for calling. Hi to you.
Good morning. Hi.
Good morning.
My comment is I'm driving north of Cumberland, and I've already seen two bald eagles this morning. My question is, what has the United States done probably the past 30 years to really help birds as an example of the bald eagle and other birds like that continue to thrive? I know that in the late 60s, early 70s, there are a number of birds that were threatened. Now things have changed. Of course, we're seeing more and more of these beautiful birds every day. Has the United States or the world, in fact, gotten better as far as using toxic waste and DDT and things like that to help these birds come along?
Well, I think we're doing some things right and we're doing some things wrong. One of the most important things that we did in the early 1970s was ban the use of DDT for agriculture here in the United States, because, you know, DDT is what drove bald eagle populations down, peregrine falcons, ospreys, brown pelicans. A lot of these birds are at the very end of very long food chains, and you had what's known as biological magnification, this chemical increasing in concentration at each step along the food chain. And so, you know, we eliminated that toxin from being put out in the environment in significant amounts. And it also, in many parts of the country, we gave these birds a helping hand by bringing them back to areas where they'd been extirpated. It's a technique known as hacking, where you would take, for example, a bald eagle chick from a nest in Saskatchewan, where they had a very healthy population of eagles, and move it to Pennsylvania or New York or some other area where the eagles had been extirpated. You do that year after year with a lot of bald eagle chicks. They grow up and eventually come back and start breeding there. And so, yeah, I mean, the bald eagle population in the lower 48 has done so well that the eagle has now been, you know, delisted from the endangered species list. The same thing with the peregrine falcon. It was rescued as a result of a very intensive program of captive breeding and release. Other species that took a hit from the DDT era, like Cooper's hawks, have come back on their own. The problem today is that, you know, the threats facing birds are much more diffuse. You can't necessarily point to just a single chemical and say, here's the problem. Earlier this year, the National Audubon Society released a report called Common Birds in Decline. And what they did was they looked at dozens of species of birds across North America that are still common, birds like eastern meadowlarks, for example. There are still tens of millions of meadowlarks. But by looking at surveys like the annual breeding bird survey and Christmas bird counts that track these populations on a continental scale, we see that the populations of many of these birds have dropped by 40, 60, even 70 or 80% over the last 40 years. They're still common today, but if those trends continue, they won't be in the future. And there's a lot of reasons behind that. I mean, habitat loss and habitat fragmentation is one of the biggest. You know, our country is just sprawling out in every direction. People have such a huge footprint. Climate change certainly is having an effect, particularly with species that breed in the Arctic, where like most of our shorebirds, for example, many of our ducks. The climate is changing rapidly up there. But there's also, I think it's you know, the warning comes early enough that we can, you know, we can take heed of it and make a difference. I live in the countryside of eastern Pennsylvania, as Larry said, and my wife and I have about an acre of ground. We're completely surrounded by cornfields and soybean fields. There's not a lot of good habitat, but we've made our property good bird habitat simply by planting a lot of native species of wildflowers, native species of shrubs, some of the native viburnum, some of the native dogwoods that bear fruit that migratory birds need in their fall migration. And so our property's become this oasis. And you can do that even if you have a suburban backyard. Just pick a corner of your property, you know, plant a couple of gray dogwood bushes or spice bush or something like that that's going to provide food for migrating tanagers and catbirds or whatever. You don't have to do a lot, But you multiply that across millions of properties in the country, and it would make a huge difference for birds.
Yeah, make a huge difference. Thanks, Dave. Appreciate your call very much. If you'd like to join in, the number to call 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions and comments. And just one more thing about the decline on birds. You talk in your book about the folks who really loved birds in hats, having them, you know, sort of a style thing at one point, that lots of birds were killed for their feathers for people's clothing.
Oh, that's right. And in fact, that was the crisis that really precipitated the first movement toward legal bird conservation and the bird conservation movement in the United States in the late 1800s and early 1900s. The millinery trade, you know, making hats, from about the Civil War on, and particularly in the 1890s, 1880s, you know, if you were a fashionable woman, you just did not go out on the street without a hat that was decorated with not just feathers, sometimes whole birds, sometimes lots of birds. Sometimes you would have a whole family of baby birds that had been killed and stuffed and put on your hat with the mama bird, you know, looking like she's feeding them. But what was really driving this were the feathers, the breeding feathers of herons and egrets, a type of feather known as an egretti. It's this long, filmy, delicate, it's a nuptial feather that the bird grows in the springtime, and they were worth more than twice their weight in gold in the late 1800s. And so as many as 200 million birds a year were being killed for the fashion trade, drove terns and gulls almost to extinction along the coast, drove most of these wading birds to the point of extinction. And so in the 1880s and 1890s, you had the growth of what eventually turned into the Audubon movement. And it really was funny that, you know, the men tried to save birds in the 1880s. Prominent conservationists like George Bird Grinnell, who started the first Audubon Society, which collapsed really within about a year and a half or 2 years of its founding. It wasn't until the 1890s that women got involved. A woman named Harriet Hemingway in Boston, who sat at absolutely at the apex of Boston society and was able to tap that social standing and tap into the women's club movement that was so vibrant across the country in those days, women fighting for universal suffrage and fighting, you know, for temperance and against poverty, and saying, basically saying, look, ladies, if you want to maintain the high moral ground, you can't be wearing the feathers of these innocent birds that are dying for fashion. And within less than 20 years, they spawned the Audubon movement. They forced legislators across the country to pass the first significant laws protecting birds, and including at the federal level, the Migratory Bird Protection Act, which was passed in 1914, is still our bedrock protection for all the wild birds, native wild birds in North America.
Yeah. Herb in Wales, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Herb.
Good morning. Interesting show. Question about Hungarian partridge. Years ago on the farm, used to see them all the time in the mid-50s, you know, either gathering, gravel after a rainstorm or in the puddles. But what's the status of Hungarian partridge nowadays?
Well, speaking from my home in Pennsylvania where we don't have any, I'm not probably the best person to be asking. But, I mean, a lot of these exotic game species were introduced by game departments around the country, particularly in the first half of the 20th century. By far the most spectacularly successful was the ringneck pheasant. In fact, we almost have to remind ourselves that ringnecks don't really belong in North America. They're an Asian species. A lot of other states tried, I mean, they tried Hungarian partridge. They tried moving, like, for example, sharp-tailed grouse out of the plains and moving them east. We brought in species like Siberian snowcocks that were released in the mountains of the Southwest, and there's still a small population in the mountains of northern Nevada. You know, chukar partridge, which are still a common game bird across the West. Most of these attempted introductions were unsuccessful in the long term because, you know, they're species that didn't necessarily belong here, might not have been well adapted here. Some of them have, like, for example, ringneck pheasants. In many parts of the country, the populations have declined simply because of habitat change. You know, the kind of farm habitats that were ideal for them 50 years ago just don't exist today in the same way they did then.
And, you know, as you write about in your book, there were many birds introduced in the United States. You have quite a story about the English sparrow, but people had wanted to bring birds from Europe over here for one reason or another.
Yeah, you know, we've got a continent with 800 species of dazzlingly beautiful birds, but that wasn't good enough for some people. And, you know, as somebody who grew up, in rural Pennsylvania hunting ringneck pheasants, I have a soft spot for ringnecks. But, I mean, a lot of these introductions were just spectacularly bad ideas. The English sparrow, which was brought over here with the idea that it would control agricultural pests and became just an incredible pest in its own right. I mean, it has been horrific for eastern bluebirds and a lot of native species that it competes with for nest sites. The European starling, which was introduced, we had these what were known as acclimatization societies, not just in America, but in many English-speaking parts of the world, where people would, as you say, bring these birds from the old world to the new world. And there was an acclimatization society in New York City that, for reasons that I guess made sense to them, were dedicated to the idea of introducing to North America all the birds mentioned in the collected works of Shakespeare. And there is one line in one play by Shakespeare in which they mentions the starling. And so they brought starlings into Central Park, released them, they died, they brought another batch in, and just our luck, that one stuck. And so we now have, you know, hundreds of millions of starlings across the country, causing a terrific amount of damage to native species that they, you know, like woodpeckers with which they compete for nest holes. You know, just it, usually that kind of biological shuffling around is never a good idea.
Yeah. Thanks, Herb. And Emil, I think it might even, and Rhinelander might even have something relating to starlings here. Emil, hi.
Yes, sir. Funny that you talk about them. All my life, I've raised starlings because they're a bird that knows to mock other birds, but they'll also mock your language, the dog squealing, the cat meow. They're just a tremendous talking bird, and we love them. And if you go on starling.com on the Internet, there's hundreds of sites where people have them as pets.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's no question. I mean, starlings are incredible birds if you can kind of divorce yourself from the ecological damage that they have caused through no fault of their own. But in this country, they're as you say, they're highly intelligent. They're a mimic, and so you can teach them to speak. And unlike all the native birds in North America, which are protected by federal law, there's absolutely no law to keep you from taking a starling and keeping it as a pet.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's one of them that you can. I know that. I saw that on the Internet also. And there's hundreds of people who got a statement, yes, I know they're a bad bird, but don't take my starling from me.
I'll tell you what, I'm very happy to see a starling in captivity compared to one out in the wild.
All right, thanks for calling. 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Before we go back to the phones, you mentioned one woman who was quite influential in helping the birds of the United States, but there were several women who played an important role in birding and in the advancement of birds in this country.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, you know, the early history of ornithology is, as the early history of most sciences, is primarily male-dominated. But by the time you get into the late 19th century, you start to have, first of all, some really prominent women scientists. And ornithologists, women like Florence Merriam, whom you could argue, you know, actually invented the modern field guide in the late 1800s, and people like Mabel Osgood Wright from Connecticut, who was a very influential, very popular writer in the late 1800s, early 1900s. She was one of the driving forces behind the early Audubon movement. She wrote a book called Birdcraft that went through like 9 editions. It was really. This is when, when birding began to become really popular as a general pastime, as people started to look at birds not just from a strictly utilitarian perspective, but as something that brings joy and beauty and interest to our lives. And, you know, and so, yes, I mean, the women have really driven that. And as you get into the 20th century, of course, you have more and more women who were making substantial contributions to ornithology as a science, to bird conservation. You know, if it hadn't been for women, the bird life we have in America today would be much, much poorer because, you know, birds were down to this keyhole in the early 1900s. years. I mean, populations were so low. And if it hadn't been for the women who stepped forward and pushed the conservation movement into the forefront, I really shudder to think what more we would have lost.
Bill in Milwaukee will give you a chance now. Hi, Bill. Thank you for calling.
Thanks for having me. I just tuned in a moment ago, so I'm not sure what your guest specialty is. But I would like to know where and when the best time, best place to see a loggerhead shrike in Wisconsin would be.
Ah, that might be hard for Scott Weidensol. Scott?
Well, it would be. I'm, you know, like I said, I'm about 500 miles east of you, and I've had the chance to bird in Wisconsin on a number of occasions, but I'm not sure that I can be quite that specific. But I'll tell you what, there, you know, almost every state has a state birding listserv on the internet, and generally speaking, the people, I mean, birders are among the friendliest people you will ever meet in your life. And if you get on one of those lists and post that question, not only am I willing to bet somebody will tell you where to go to see that shrike, you may have somebody offering to take you there themselves. Birders love nothing more than sharing birds with other people.
Yeah, and there are a couple of websites that relate to Wisconsin. One that shows this, and here I am talking about it without having the website, but we can dredge that up and have it before the end of the program, I'm pretty sure. That actually shows where the sightings have occurred for every bird, essentially. So people are posting online, and so it's something that's happening all the time. So it's really I wish I could give you that website right off the top of my head, Bill, but I can't. But Scott's right. There are lots of people who are quite willing to help you find that shrike. That's for sure.
You know, that's, I mean, speaking of common birds in decline, I mean, shrike is one species that has really taken it on the chin. All across its range. It's a grassland bird. Its populations have been plummeting. We're not really sure why, if it's habitat loss directly or habitat change, or if there's something that more fundamental at work there. And it's becoming a very difficult bird to find. I mean, here in my home state of Pennsylvania, shrikes are now extirpated. They haven't been breeding here for years. And it's one of the species that we're most concerned about.
Hmm. Scott Weidensol, our guest today, he is the author of the book titled Of a Feather, A Brief History of American Birding. It's published by Harcourt. Really pleased to have him with us here today. I'm Larry Mueller, Jim Packard, our producer, on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Really happy to have you listening in here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio as we visit with Scott Weidensol, author of the book Of a Feather. It's a brief history of American birding, although it's it's comprehensive. It's about 350 pages thereabouts. Jim Packard joining us. And Jim, you've had a chance to read the book yourself. It's a wonderful book.
I've read the book, and I've noted that you will run across John White, Mark Catesby, John Lawson, Alexander Wilson, Thomas Say, and you'll say, well, what have all of these people got to do with me? Actually, they're very important in the history and the chronology of birding as a movement in America, and you'll find out about that. You'll find out about the role of women like Martha Maxwell and Florence Morrison and Harriet Lawrence Hemingway and what they had to do and how you've benefited from that in this book, which is Of a Feather. And as you can tell in listening to the show, Scott Weidensol is a very informative guest who's able to elaborate on all of these things and has written several books about nature and birding in the past. But then this one is this history of the characters, the people involved in American birding. And it's available to you right now with your pledge at 800-383-9772 or at WPR.org. A $150 pledge gets you a copy of this, the hardcover copy of this book. It's just out. And also will get you the member benefit card. And Larry, I know that it's important for us to hit our goals today because we have a $12,000 goal and we have a challenge grant to help us meet it.
Yeah, we sure do. We have a challenge grant of $1,500 from an anonymous donor when we make our show goal. So when we make that $12,000, we'll have an extra $1,500 put into the pot. And the only way we do that is with your help and with your contributions. Here on every Wednesday on Wisconsin Public Radio from 11 to 12:30, we try to cover things that relate to nature and the out of doors. it might be Scott Craven on the first Wednesday of the month talking about the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife. It might be authors like Scott Weidensall, who Scott's talking about his book with us today, Of a Feather. But really, that's the day that we really try to bring the natural world into your home and into your radio. So it's a good day for you to listen to that kind of programming here on Wisconsin Public Radio. We hope you enjoy that kind of programming. And certainly when you enjoy that kind of programming, we hope you will call in with a contribution at 1-800-383-9772. It's 1-800-383-9772. Or go online to WPR.org. WPR.org. You can make your contribution right online, and you can print out your receipt, and you'll have it all taken care of, and you'll be done for the day. And even online, I believe, Jim, you can use your credit card, obviously, mm-hmm. but you can also, I think, you can make setups for some other things as well, like electronic funds transfer, if you want to do it that way. So there are a lot of ways to do it online or just by picking up that phone and calling 1-800-383-9772. Our goal for the first hour of the program is $7,000, so we got about $6,000 to go to reach that goal. So we've got a ways to go, Jim, but we can do that.
We can do it, and especially if you've never called before, let's draw some attention to you. You've started listening to Wisconsin Public Radio, or maybe you've been a longtime listener and never pledged before. It's very easy. It's toll-free at 800-383-9772. You can get a copy of the book Of a Feather and also the member benefit card, which entitles you to two nights for the price of one at some bed and breakfast in Wisconsin, Illinois, and Minnesota, some online shopping discounts, some performance and attraction benefits, two-for-one admission, and then two-for-one entrees at over 250 restaurants. That's the member benefit card, and we'll send both of them to you with your pledge of $150. You can ask questions, you can leave comments, but we'd love to hear from you because we really want to make this goal of $12,000 for the program, and we can only do it when you make your call at 800-383-9772.
We have a nice community of listeners here for Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm not sure exactly. I think around 500,000 people who listen to Wisconsin Public Radio, and about 1 in 20, is it? Or is it 1 in 10 people who, about 1 in 10 people who contribute during our pledge drives. We have a couple of pledge drives a year or so, and so when those occur, it's about 10% of the people who listen actually call in with a contribution. Maybe you've never contributed to Wisconsin Public Radio, or maybe you haven't contributed in a long time. What a great time to do it. What a great hour to do it, because you're helping us reach our goal, and also you're helping us get that extra $1,500 in the form of a challenge grant, and that really helps us out. About 30% or so of our program operating budget comes directly from you or someone just like you, and it really is important for you, if you enjoy, or I know you enjoy, or you wouldn't be listening, the kinds of programmings that we produce here on Wisconsin Public Radio. This is really the time to help us out. And with a $6,000 or so to go, Jim, we've got a ways to go here to reach our goal for the hour, and then we've got another $5,000 later on to make the total of $12,000. But let's first hit that $7,000 goal. Let's hit that right now. We do that with your help at 1-800-383-9772 or go online to WPR.org. You know, whatever amount you feel comfortable with, that's what we'd like you to contribute. Think about that. What's the goal for you? What do you think you can afford to contribute? Maybe it's more than $150. Maybe it's $500. Or maybe it's less than $150. Maybe it's $120. We'll still send you the member benefit card at $120. But whatever the amount, when you donate, you're going to be helping us a lot. When you contribute to Wisconsin Public Radio, you're helping to keep these kinds of programs on the air. And it's a great vote on this Wednesday for the outdoor, the environmental type programming that we do here from 11 to 12:30 every week.
Wisconsin Public Radio has been around in one form or another for 90 years, 1917, and now we're at 2007, 90 years. So you can see that there's a lot of history. You've had a chance to listen to the service over the years. Now we're asking for your financial support. And have you ever wanted to listen to Wisconsin Public Radio and to Larry, but weren't near a radio? Well, you can listen online anytime from anywhere in the world. You go to WPR.org and click to listen. That website also has information on other favorite shows or guests that you've heard. And your pledge helps support all of these services. That's why it's important to maintain the 800 service that you enjoy using as you travel around the state. Or that we have various bureaus around the state in Superior, in Milwaukee, in La Crosse, and other places as well. We're paying for that with your phone calls. So that's why it's so important that we hear from you, that you help us make this goal to obtain the $1,200 challenge grant. And we can do that with your pledge right now at 800-383-9772, or you can go online at WPR.org.
Got a nice note from Jim Hankin of Wisconsin and Whitefish Bay Area, who pledged in memory of Betty Hankin, who died earlier this year. Betty was a long-time listener to the program. She often called the program. She especially enjoyed the outdoor programs, the Garden Talk programs, and the environmental and outdoor programs that we provided. So, Jim, I want to thank you very much for that contribution in Betty's memory. I had many chances to talk to her, and I enjoyed that very, very much. She was part of our community of listeners here at Wisconsin Public Radio, and was a longtime contributor. And I often wonder, what converts a Wisconsin Public Radio listener into a contributor? Well, one reason is that you want to make a difference. It's a desire to make a difference. And it turns out that a lot of people who listen to Wisconsin Public Radio are the same people who like to get involved in activities to improve the communities where they live. And giving to Wisconsin Public Radio is one of those activities. So your membership today will not only pay for the programs you listen to, it also creates the opportunity for somebody else in your neighborhood to discover Wisconsin Public Radio. So whether it be $60 or whether it be $120 or $150 or $500, the membership helps keep NPR News. It helps keep these Conversations with Larry Mueller programs from 11 to 12:30 every day going, and the great discussions that we have with listeners. That does make a difference in our community. So we'd love to have you join us now. Process just takes a couple of minutes. The benefits, well, the benefits last a lifetime. Here's the number. Call us now at 1-800-383-9772, 1-800-383-9772, or pledge online at WPR.org. For a $150 contribution, we'll send you that book, Of a Feather. But whatever amount is reasonable for you, that's the amount we'd like you to contribute.
Again, we will not share your name or personal information that you give to us. Some companies will match or perhaps even double your contribution, so you'd want to check with your human resources office about that. But right now the decision is how much will I pledge? And the average pledge leading up to the drive has been about $120. And at that level, we would be happy to send you a copy of the member benefit card with dining benefits, performance and attraction benefits, and, of course, the bed and breakfast benefits. But if you pledge at $150, then we would be glad to send along a copy of A Feather, The Brief History of American Birding by Scott Wiesensohl. And that's available when you pledge at $150 at 800-383-9772. Larry, I misspoke. I said that challenge that we have facing us is $1,200. Actually, it's $1,500.
$1,500.
I misspoke on that. And so you can see that it's even more important that you make your pledge right now.
And, you know, we've heard from Ellen in Elm Grove. Now, listen to what she says. She says, I even look forward to returning from vacation just to get back to listening to the Ideas Network. I like that. Ellen, thank you very much. Julie in Manitowoc says, I just listen all the time to get my to give my fair share. I want to continue this liberal arts education I'm getting. And, you know, we do give a kind of a nice education here, I think, on Wisconsin Public Radio. Jeff in Racines, he listens all the time, likes this particular program very much, and that's why he's contributed during this hour. Well, what about you now? If you haven't contributed yet, or maybe it's time to renew your contributions to Wisconsin Public Radio, be a great time to do it. We have our goal of $12,000 for the 90 minutes of the program. We need your help to reach that goal in order to get that challenge grant of $1,500. You can pledge online at WPR.org, or you can call us toll-free at 1-800-383-9772. 1-800-383-9772. Call right now. Make your contribution. Again, you're going to love this book, Of a Feather. Jim and I have both read it. We both loved it very much. You'll like it, too. If you can contribute $150, we'll be happy to send you a copy. And we'll do it, by the way, before the holidays. We'll do that.
That's a good thing to do. And you can get your copy when you pledge at 800-383-9772. You don't have to pay everything now. You can pay in monthly installments. You can use your electronic funds transfer. Your credit card would be your Visa, your MasterCard, your Amex, or your Discover card. Any one of those options is available to you. So why not make this opportunity today to make a statement on behalf of Larry and Wisconsin Public Radio at 800-383-9772. A vote for Larry, a phone call for Larry is a vote for your continued enjoyment for the next year. So give us a call.
1-800-383-9772, or go online to WPR.org. And we'll be going to the news, but we'll be back with Scott Wydensaw, and he's got more things to say about birds and birding here in the United States. Stay with us here on the IdeasNet. Talking now with Scott Wydensaw, who is the author of the book Of a Feather. He is a much sought after expert on nature and birds. He's written several books. He is a federally licensed bird bander, lives in the Pennsylvania area, and we're really pleased to have him with us today. And certainly you can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890, 263-1890. And Scott, I wanted to have you talk a little bit about Roger Torrey Peterson, because it's another big name and somebody who had a huge impact on birding.
Oh, that's for sure, and you know, one of the names that even if you're not a birder, you certainly recognize. Peterson grew up in the early part of the 20th century in western New York, was nuts about birds, and from a fairly early age, when he was in his late teens and early 20s, really was on the cutting edge of bird identification. He moved to New York City to pursue art training and fell in with a group called the Bronx County Bird Club, a bunch of fellow teenage boys who were just crazy about birds, and who were learning these new techniques for identifying live birds in the field, looking at them with a pair of binoculars instead of shooting them with a shotgun. And because Peterson was such a good artist, he was able to take all of that skill in the field that he had acquired with his colleagues in New York, and convert that in 1934 into the first really usable modern field guide. I mean, there have been field guides going back to the early 1800s, two volumes set by a scientist named Thomas Nuttall with little woodcut illustrations. But, I mean, Peterson's field guide was the first one that made it possible for the average person who didn't know anything about birds to walk outside with a pair of binoculars and look at this, bewildering, colorful, melodic confusion of birds and make sense out of it. And that's what really sparked the boom in bird watching that continues today. I mean, just a few weeks ago, the government released figures that suggest that 81 million Americans are interested in birds.
Isn't that amazing? That's an amazing number.
It is. Now, that's not to say that there's 81 million birders, which is actually how the government put it.
Right.
It covers everybody from, your great aunt Matilda who puts seed out for the chickadees in the wintertime, to the friends I have back here in the East who keep a suitcase packed in the hall closet at all times so that they can literally grab it, get on a plane, fly to Alaska this weekend to see a new bird that's shown up there, and fly back in time for work on Monday morning. So we're talking, it's a pretty wide range here that we're talking. But, there's 81 million Americans to whom birds are important, who go out of their way to notice birds and pay attention to birds. And that figures up dramatically from just 10 years ago when it was about 60 million. So, birding remains one of, if not the fastest growing outdoor form of recreation in the country.
You know, a couple of years back, I interviewed Mark Omasek about his book, The Big Year, and I noticed that was in your bibliography. And there's sort of really a couple wide extremes here on the bird watching side. And the big year person is really on the one extreme, I believe.
Oh, yeah. And in fact, you had said at the beginning of the show, you know, you weren't sure whether to call it bird watching a sport or a hobby. And of course, it can be all of those things, you know, depending on how you approach it. You know, it can be intensely competitive, and people who undertake these big years to see if they can see more species than anybody else has seen within the boundaries of North America in one calendar year, these are among the most obsessive. It's almost always men, and they burn through, you know, sometimes tens of thousands of dollars, go through their entire life savings, you know, zipping back and forth from the Florida Keys to Attu and in the extreme western Aleutian Islands, back and forth. One of the most interesting big years is one that a friend of mine did, a fellow named Ken Kaufman, who's one of the best birders in the country, one of the best birders in the world. And when Ken was a teenager in the 1970s, after having dropped out of high school to just hitchhike around the country and watch birds, he decided to do a big year and did the whole thing, pretty much the whole thing, by hitchhiking. I think it cost him about $1,000 for the whole year. And he came within a whisker of breaking the record, although he is proud to assert he certainly spent the least amount of money per bird, and that's a record that, you know, nobody's ever going to break again.
Yeah, you point that out. He spent like a dollar something a bird.
Yeah, something like that.
And that's as opposed to other people who actually hired several people to help plan a big year.
Oh yeah, I mean there was one fellow who was a very successful businessman. He hired some of the best birders in the country, including Ken Kaufman, to design a package for him to travel around the country in the most efficient way to see the greatest number of birds. And, you know, people will talk about how this, you know, this guy came out, walked up, looked at this bird, you know, looked at it for 30 seconds, ticked it off his list, and left. And I got to tell you, you know, speaking personally here, that sort of thing drives me nuts.
Yeah.
I keep a life list. Most birders do. I'm not obsessive about it, and most birders aren't. But the idea of treating birds just as inventory, I think, is, you know, it's such a gross disservice to the bird itself.
Yeah.
You know, and one of the things that I talk about in the book that disturbs me is that I don't know that there's really the culture of conservation among birders that there needs to be. I mean, obviously there is a culture of conservation there. Birders, you know, tend to be very concerned about the environment. But in terms of turning that into direct action, I mean, I've been a hunter and an angler all my life, and, you know, sportsmen have had it drummed into their heads practically from the cradle that conservation is expensive and you got to pay for it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, through excise taxes on sporting arms, excise taxes on fishing tackle, you know, there are hundreds of millions of dollars a year poured back into wildlife conservation by hunters and anglers. And we don't have a mechanism yet for birders to do the same thing. There have been suggestions that, you know, that there be a 10% excise tax on bird seed and field guides and binoculars. And there's been a tremendous amount of pushback about that from manufacturers and from retailers. Well, if even a small fraction of those 81 million people in America who like birds stepped forward and said, you know what, bird conservation is important to me. The only way we're going to really conserve birds is if we have money to pay for conservation work, and I'm willing to pay an extra 10% for my field guide. And that seems like a really very reasonable stance to me. If all of those birders stepped forward and said that, we'd have it tomorrow. But we just haven't gotten to that point yet, and that's something that, you know, that really worries me a little bit.
You know, you have a picture of a cardinal on the cover of your book, and I think Randy in Menominee has a question about cardinals. Randy, hi.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. My question is, for years as we've been feeding the birds, we've always had several pairs of cardinals that we've enjoyed watching, and this year we started out with a couple pair, and we haven't seen any for a long time now. I wonder where they went.
Well, there could be a couple of reasons for that. I mean, cardinals are not migratory. They're territorial and year-round residents. And it may just be that something happened to the cardinals right in your immediate area and you have a vacant territory there. And it, you know, but nature abhors a vacuum, and if it's been good good for cardinals in the past. It'll be good for cardinals in the future. I'm assuming there hasn't been any kind of major change in the landscape, like the vacant lot next door was turned into a house or a soccer field or something like that. Because I mean, and you chuckle, Larry, but really, people I think sometimes forget how that incremental change in the landscape eventually has an impact on birds. These birds can't live on Kentucky bluegrass lawns manicured to within a breadth of its life. They need, nature likes a mess. They need some, cardinals need shrubby habitat. And, as more and more of that habitat gets developed, it really does eventually have a noticeable impact on bird populations.
By the way, you mentioned that you've done improvements on your acre, and how many bird species do you see typically in a year on your home land there, right out your back door?
Well, I'm not a big lister, so I mean, I keep a list of the species that we've seen here, but I can't quote the number to you off the top of my head. But a surprising amount, and of course, particularly during the spring and fall migration. The great thing about this time of the year is every morning when I step off the back porch, it's like a whole new world out there.
Yeah.
Because overnight, you have these waves of migrant birds, most of which migrate after dark. And, at daybreak, they come pouring down in, and you just, this morning I walked outside, and we'd had a major fallout last night of northern sparrows. A lot of the white-throated and white-crowned sparrows are coming through, Savannah sparrows. We've had Lincoln sparrows here. They weren't here a week ago. The warblers that were coming through in tremendous numbers 3 weeks ago have pretty much ended. If I sound a little groggy today, it's because I was in the woods until 2 o'clock this morning catching saw-whet owls, these beautiful little fist-sized owls that are migrating through the upper Midwest and the East in tremendous numbers at this time of the year. I can guarantee you that your listeners in anywhere in Wisconsin, last night there were saw-whet owls migrating over their homes. These birds about the size of a man's fist that most serious bird watchers have never seen. So, these migratory birds just bring the whole world to your backyard.
As a birder, is there one bird you most want to see that you haven't seen yet?
Oh, well, there's 10,000 species of birds in the world. So it's a long list. I'm actually... my wife and I are heading to Mexico shortly, down in the mountains of eastern Mexico, and there's some great birds there that we're looking forward to see. But I'm not a picky birder.
No.
If it's got feathers, I'm content. House sparrows. I'll watch house sparrows if there's nothing else around to watch, because they're fascinating. They're fascinating animals, and we still know so little about what's going on between their ears.
Scott Weidensahl, our guest today. Author of the book Of a Feather, A Brief History of American Birding. Jim Packer joining us. Jim, I'm a little like Scott Weidensahl in that sense. Scott was talking about, he'll watch sparrows, and we have probably more English sparrows at our feeders than anything else, and they're a lot of fun. They're a lot of fun to watch.
They are indeed. And we'd like to watch cardinals in our backyard.
Mm-hmm.
And we hope that you'll feather our nest with your phone call. We really need some seed money here to feed the appetites of the people who are volunteering and taking your phone call at 800-383-9772. We don't want to beat our wings about this, but we need to meet our goal, and our goal for the program is $12,000. So we need to jump in and do some work here. And that means that you decide how much it is that you're going to pledge, and either pledge online at WPR.org or call us at 800-383-9772. And we want to make sure that we pick up that $1,500 challenge grant, Larry.
Absolutely. And Scott Weidensahl was talking about what a difference it would make for birders if everybody contributed just a little bit to help the birds of this country. And I tell you what, it's sort of the same thing with Wisconsin Public Radio. If we had everyone who listens to Wisconsin Public Radio make a contribution, it would be pretty easy to meet our goals. That's not going to happen, but I tell you what, a lot of people will, and you might be one of those people. It can start with you, with a contribution at 1-800-383-9772, 1-800-383-9772, or go online to WPR.org. And you can join Elizabeth and John and Trempolo, who listen quite a bit to this particular program. They also listen to Chapter a Day and to Kathleen Dunn as well. Susan from New Mexico called in with a, or probably went online with a contribution. Maybe she called in the name of Ray Pelmonis, also known as Fisherman Ray. And I recently met Ray and had a chance to fish with him and in the World Muskie Fishing Championships. And Susan says to Ray, get well soon and get back to fishing. He's must have laid up a little bit, I guess. Well, Ray's one of those people, too, who will call in with a contribution. There's no doubt about that. Jane in McFarland, longtime listener, tries to contribute as often as she can. Mark in Fitchburg says, thanks for doing what you do. I wish I could give more. Well, I tell you what, Mark's like a lot of people. You can. Some people can afford a lot. Some people can't afford as much. Whatever is reasonable to you, whatever you think you can afford, that's really any whatever amount is comfortable, I guess, is what I could say. It's the best way to say it. Whatever amount is comfortable with you is fine. If you can contribute $120, we'll send you the member benefit card. With the two-for-one dining and the two nights for the price of one at the bed and breakfast. If you add $30 to that amount, make it $150, we'll send you a copy of Scott Weidensall's book, Of a Feather, A Brief History of American Birding, a fascinating book. And it's only available during this program. We've got about 9 minutes to go. You can call us now at 1-800-383-9772, 1-800-383-9772, or by going online to WPR.org, WPR.org. Go online, make your contribution. It's nice to hear from Susan all the way from New Mexico. What about you right here in Wisconsin, or maybe in Illinois, or maybe you're listening in Minnesota, or even Michigan, the Upper Peninsula? We have quite a few listeners. Wherever you are, time to join our family and our community of listeners who contribute to Wisconsin Public Radio. Again, 1-800-383-9772.
When you make your call or make your pledge online, you'll discover that electronic funds transfer is one of the options available to you to pay for your pledge. You don't have to pay everything at one time. You can authorize your bank to make a withdrawal for you on a monthly or quarterly basis, however you choose to set this up, and take care of your pledge that way. At $150, we'd be happy to take a pledge that would include a copy of Scott's new book, Of a Feather, Brief History of American Birding. And he has that challenge at the end for people to do more about conserving the birds. So this is not only this history of the birding, but it's also a challenge to birders to do more and to get more people involved. And I think it's a worthwhile challenge. And our challenge to you is how much are you going to pledge? What is that decision going to be? We want to make sure that it's an amount that's comfortable for you. And you must know that it's very important to us, because all of the calls put together add up to a successful drive. And that's what we want to do. So make your pledge right now at 800-383-9772 or at WPR.org.
This book in particular, I think, would make a nice gift for anyone who is a great birder. And, of course, we'll get that book out to you before the holiday season, so you'll have it to give as a gift. As we were kind of kidding you yesterday, when I do that, I get the book and I read it, and I'm really careful with how I read it first, and then I can pass it on to someone else as a gift. I don't know if that's cheating or
is it regifting.
It's a regifting, I guess, is what you might call it. I try to do that with many books, and well, you can do the same thing with your contribution of $150. We'll send you that copy of that book and the member benefit card as well. And frankly, when you get the member benefit card, which you can get, by the way, for a $120 contribution, you will pay for your entire membership in Wisconsin Public Radio very easily, because there's 250 restaurants around the state. I've used it. I frankly, this last year, I covered my cost of my membership, and I contribute more than I'm in that 9XM leadership circle area, and I've covered the cost of that pretty much with two-for-one dining. But there's also now, I'm going to have to take my wife on a bed and breakfast outing on a weekend here. That'd be kind of a nice romantic outing.
It would be, you know, you've got the two nights for the price of one.
Yeah.
You've got a couple of restaurants that would be included on there that you can go to. So really it adds up to be a very frugal sort of investment here in what you're doing. And then is getting the benefit of programming all year long, as well as the short-term benefit of an exciting night at one of the 44 bed and breakfasts or the 250 restaurants that are involved in the Wisconsin Public Radio member benefit card. The card is available at $120, but for $150, we'll also throw in Scott Wiedensohl's book, Of a Feather, The Brief History of American Birding. But why not make this decision right now to support Wisconsin Public Radio? It's important to you. You listen on a regular basis. You can hardly stand to miss Larry's show. Try to plan your day so you've got some free time or some time to devote to the program, because it's a program that you get involved in. Larry likes to say, if it's a bad show, whose fault is it?
Well, it's probably my fault. It's probably my fault. We try not to have bad shows. We like good shows. We like good guests like Scott Wiedensohl, people who know a lot. And on Wednesdays is our environment and our outdoor day when we really try to cover those sorts of issues. We'll also talk about things like bioenergy, but we zero in on the wildlife. We zero in on authors who have written about the outdoors and nature and the wildlife. On our Wednesday programs, we bring in oftentimes people from the DNR to talk. We have Scott Craven, of course, the first Wednesday of every month. And they would all tell you that they support this program. They love being on. They love a chance to talk with you and answer your questions. Now it's your turn to help us meet that challenge grant of $1,500 with your contribution. Maybe you could contribute $1,500. That'd be all right, too. But whatever amount you can afford would be great, and it is always welcome. And we've had a whole range of contributions that have come through the program, from a few dollars all the way up into the many thousands of dollars for a particular show. One of my shows, as a matter of fact, was several thousand dollars donated by, contributed by one individual or one couple. So you can make a difference right now by calling 1-800-383-9772 or by going online to WPR.org. Make your contribution now. You're going to be, if you make that $150 contribution, we'll send you the book Of a Feather, which I think retails for around $30 anyway. So it's in about that range. So you'd be purchasing the book. Read it yourself. Give it to someone else for the holiday, because we'll get it out to you by the holidays. And you'll feel good knowing you've supported Wisconsin Public Radio and you've got a great book to read as well. 1-800-383-9772. Getting down to the last 2 or 3 minutes here, Jim.
Indeed. And you know, you can listen to Wisconsin Public Radio every day for years and you'll never get a bill. Even though we provide a service every day, 24 hours a day, much like a utility or a phone company, you do not receive monthly bills for usage. Instead, we use the honor system, and we count on you to make a pledge, and you can make your pledge right now at 800-383-9772, or you can go online at WPR.org. For a $150 pledge, we'll be glad to send a copy of Scott's book Of a Feather, The Brief History of American Birding, and also the member benefit card, and enables you to get dining benefits, performance and attractions benefits, online shopping discounts, bed and breakfast benefits, a very popular card, and it's yours with your pledge of $150 right now.
1-800-383-9772. 1-800-383-9772. We'll send you a bill in the mail. You can use your credit card, which I have used in the past for portions of my contributions. You can go to electronic funds transfer. You can just write a check and get it over with right one time. However you want to do it, you have to make that decision. But I hope you'll make that decision in the next minute and a half, because you'll be putting in a vote for this particular program at 1-800-383-9772. Go online otherwise to WPR.org. Whichever way works for you best is the way we want you to do it. Whichever amount, that you want to contribute, whatever is comfortable for you, that's what we want you to contribute. Time is running out. We're going to have to go away. A big thanks to Scott Weidensaw, and thanks to everyone who's contributed so far. If you haven't contributed, now's the time to do it. 1-800-383-9772. Go online to WPR.org. And thanks for contributing, and thanks for listening.